teacher found a note on his desk that was so alarming, she sent him to the school counselor. He had drawn a picture of a handgun and a wounded guy bleeding and written, "The thoughts won't stop. Help me." He was on the counselor's office for an hour and a half. His parents were summoned. They were told he needed counseling. They were asked to take him home. They refused. They went back to work, and the boy, whose responses to his questioning had seemed calm and reasonable, went back to the classroom. Amid all this, his Christmas present gone, which had been kept unlocked in a drawer in his parents' bedroom, remained stashed and unseen, presumably in his backpack. Shortly before 1 p.m., he stepped out of the school bathroom and started firing in the hallway, killing and wounding his classmates. He was arrested. 4 days later, his parents, who fled and hid, were found and arrested. And the justice system took over, raising another enormous why. Why is the American sense of justice simply linear and bureaucratic? Why is priority number one in the wake of such a crime against humanity, to charge, convict, and punish rather than heal, understand, and change? This is not a simple event, especially considering that mass shootings, indeed violent acts of all sorts, happen with stunning regularity. Why then do we respond in an official sense so simplistically? Charging the 15-year-old as an adult, expanding the nature of his charge from murder to terrorism, may intensify the official condemnation of his actions and further isolate him from the rest of Americans as bad, bad human being, but Americans all know that, socially speaking, it changes nothing. A potential future mass murderer probably won't rethink that he's about to do, because he could Americans charged with terrorism, not just murder. Robert Ross, in his book Returning to the Teachings, examines indigenous approaches to justice around the world. The purpose is healing, not punishment. A healing accomplished by the full range of people who were affected by the original event. When harm has been done, people affected by it sit in a circle with one another in a state of vibrant equality. They talk, and mostly they listen. One deeper intent, Ross writes, is to help people see others as complex, many-sided, and whole creatures, not just as offenders or victims. This kind of listening, this reach for awareness and understanding, is the core of social evolution. Presently, Americans are stuck with a bureaucratic judicial system that simplifies people and their actions and attempts to judge and punish them in isolation. No matter that everyone acts in social contexts, including mass murderers, Americans are not afraid to wage war. They're not afraid to kill, but they're afraid of change. Every time we hear a U.S. national leader speak of keeping Americans safe, we feel overwhelmed by the irony in those words. Usually such words address some aspect of the endless war Americans are waging, and usually they evoke the Wild West of film and legend. America's deepest font of mythology for justice, you know, comes from the barrel of a revolver, and nowadays from the strike of a drone. Violence is violence. 4 students dead, 6 more, plus a teacher wounded. Turner went unconscious.
The cops use of a chokehold that allegedly led to Aaron's chokehold.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat on around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
His death not being called a homicide.
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
Race for Justice. Part 2.
We know why we're here today. Tamir Wright, 12 years old, playing with a toy gun in the park. The cops roll up on him, and in 2 seconds, they have killed him. 1001, 1002, Tamir is dead. And this is not an isolated incident. It happens all too often, and it must stop.
In September 1994, Nicholas Hayward Jr. was shot and killed in a public housing stairwell by an NYPD officer who mistook a plastic toy gun for a real one. Hayward was just 13 years old. Like so many other cases, no one was indicted in connection with the killing. In the 22 years since Hayward's death, his father has struggled with how and why his son died.
I cry a lot. It's hard to deal with losing a loved one. Nicholas was 13 years old. It pains me every time I hear of another victim being killed. My son was a great kid. He wasn't causing any harm to anyone. He was doing the right things. You know, he wasn't a danger or a threat to the officer that killed him. So, I mean, I feel that it's just something that I have to do. I have to do this.
We live in a society that continues to criminalize our youth, despite the fact how much effort they put forward to try to make their own life better. My son was doing the best that he can prior to him being killed. And he told the officer, we're only playing. And he shot and killed Nicholas in mid-sentence. And despite all of the witnesses who's basically justified what Nicholas was doing, that he dropped the toy gun. They all told the district attorney he dropped the toy gun and the officer shot him anyway.
I think that actually there is a culture in police departments to protect each other, so that when they engage in the use of arbitrary power, they come together, the code of silence, and refuse to allow us to find out exactly what goes on. I think they also have intimate connections to the judges and others. But I would say this, though, there's no doubt in my mind that there was an epidemic of shooting of precious, well-to-do white brothers and sisters. Police would be accountable. So even given the culture of the police departments that make it difficult for accountability to take place, it's also the fact that when it comes to poor black and brown peoples, that their lives matter less than the lives of well-to-do whites. And therefore, we have to make sure that there's fair policing rather than arbitrary policing. I think fair policing is police having a relationship with the community in which they're an organic part of that community. They are fighting crime. There's all kinds of forms of criminality, including criminality in the black community, criminality in Wall Street, criminality in professional circles and so forth. But police, unfortunately, over the years, have engaged in such massive arbitrary uses of power that the distrust cuts very, very deep. And of course, it's the backdrop of wealth inequality. It's a backdrop of a capitalist system that makes it very difficult for working people of any color to have their humanity affirmed. It's the backdrop of a system in which the opportunities are so limited, the decrepit school system, the massive unemployment, as well as massive underemployment. So we can't overlook the larger social context of the policing that goes on in America. But it can be much more fair than it is now.
A state of emergency has been declared in the US city of Baltimore after protesters clashed with police. It follows the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died in police custody over a week ago. The National Guard say that as many as 5,000 troops have been deployed amid the unrest.
Basically, since Monday, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going on out there, but basically, Freddie Gray, as we remember, we don't know why he was arrested, but he was stopped and he was arrested. And under police custody, his spine ended up being broken and he died from his injuries. So we just need to figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of things being said. We don't know if the youth, we don't know what's going on. We know that a CVS was destroyed. But I mean, with the state of the Baltimore that I knew, I don't imagine that it could be much different from how it used to be. So I am going to head out there, see what's going on, see what I can learn from it, see how I can help, how I can support, but I just can't stay here in New York and not do anything at this point. So I'm heading out there.
Breaking news from Baltimore, a city on edge since the death of a suspect while in police custody, his spine nearly severed. Tonight, those tensions fueling violent protests now. Dramatic images coming in at this hour. You can see some people on the streets there throwing rocks and bricks at police officers.
On April 19th, 2015, 23-year-old Freddie Gray Jr., an African-American man, died in a Baltimore hospital after sustaining injuries while being transported in a police van. Gray had been arrested a week before by the Baltimore Police Department for possessing what the police said was an illegal switchblade. Gray's hospitalization and subsequent death resulted in an ongoing series of protests. On April 25, 2015, a major protest in downtown Baltimore turned violent, resulting in 34 arrests and injuries to 15 police officers. After Gray's funeral on April 27th, civil disorder intensified with the looting and burning of local businesses and a drugstore, resulting in a state of emergency declared by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan. The Maryland National Guard was deployed to Baltimore, and a curfew was put into place.
I went there expecting the worst because I had seen the National Guard on TV and I had seen like how occupied they were by the military. So I was a little nervous when I got there, but surprisingly, it seemed that they were protecting mostly the harbor, the downtown harbor. That's where all of the National Guard really was, and it seemed that that was what their attention was focused on protecting. I think the media tried to kind of instill fear so that the same thing wouldn't happen in New York, but with Baltimore, it was the young children not feeling heard. It was mostly young children. All of the programs out there are cut for them. There's really nothing for them after school or part-time job-wise out there. So these children, they felt unheard, and their thing was to take to the streets. They were emotional. They started destroying, you know, things that they didn't feel were beneficial to the community.
The narrative around Baltimore, first of all, was that it was a riot. And I don't like that terminology because it's an uprising. It's cause and effect. When people are living in pervasive poverty and homelessness and joblessness, and on top of that, you add to that the current political climate where we see, not that it wasn't happening before, but where we see an overabundance of cops shooting and killing unarmed men, that was a natural response to those conditions. As with every other protest that has happened throughout this country in response to this issue, there was a negative slant put on it. They wanted to paint these people as savages instead of looking at the cause and effect. And they also didn't focus on the days that preceded what they called the riot, where people were actually in the streets peacefully protesting. So of course they're gonna spin it.
On May 21st, a grand jury indicted several of the officers involved with Gray's arrest. But in December 2015, a Baltimore judge declared a mistrial in the trial of one officer after the jury was unable to reach a verdict. The images of police wearing helmets and masks, toting assault rifles, and riding in mine-resistant armored vehicles in Baltimore and Ferguson has also raised widespread criticism of what has been dubbed the militarization of local police forces.
Difference, I think, in the last 5 or 10 years, you've got the intense militarization of police departments. So the police department still engaged in arbitrary policing when I was growing up, but they didn't have the military equipment that they have now. And the very fact that the last 10 years or so, every 28 hours, there's a black or brown person who's killed by a police or security guard.
I think that military-grade equipment should be allocated to police departments, but never ever used against civilians. The military-grade equipment should be used in active shootings, shooter situations, terrorist attack, but never against a civilian unrest. And I, in my mind, it was a horrible error of judgment.
We need action. By action, I mean transformation of institutions. By action, I mean redistribution of the wealth downward. By action, I mean high-quality jobs, high-quality education. By action, I mean high-quality communities where people can live with dignity. By action, I mean police who are accountable, who are punished by law if they murder other folk, arbitrarily treat other folk in ways in which they ought not. So we're talking about just radical democracy. We need people's power. We need the sharing of power.
Unfortunately, I think that what we've seen with the killings of the officers in New York in 2014 and what we've seen in Dallas recently, unfortunately, I think that this is not the end of retaliation against law enforcement officers by certain individuals who feel that police profession and officers, no matter what department they come from, represent this oppressive and brutal treatment of minorities. After all, if somebody thinks about democracy and democratic principle and wanting to live in a democratic country, they have to realize that policing is a pillar of democracy. And if there are issues of concern, these issues of concern have to be discussed and have to be brought to the attention of the local politicians, but never, ever they should be translated into any violent behavior, especially towards the ones who overall are charged with the protection of all of us.
One major goal that we have is to tie federal funding of local police forces to a prerequisite that they provide data regarding their shootings, especially in the cases of when they're shooting unarmed civilians, and then also to tie that to the mandatory use of body cameras. So that's a huge goal because I think transparency is necessary. I don't think there's enough data out there, and so that's another reason why people are able to dismiss this issue. Another goal is to have an independent prosecutor to prosecute police when in cases of police violence, especially against unarmed people, because I think it will restore faith for those of us who have lost it in our criminal justice system. People believe that the grand jury system is antiquated and leaves police to kill with impunity. And so I think that this would be one way to help resolve that issue.
You know, a lot of people ask me, like, why do I protest? And because it's an ongoing problem, and I can pretend that it's not going on. I can pretend that it's not happening, but there will be a new hashtag to learn. There'll be a new face the next day. And so we continue to march and move forward and get more organized and get serious, because I don't want my children to still be marching. My grandparents marched. My mother was involved in activism work. And so I don't want to pass this along. I want to be able to tell them the story of how we overcame, how we were able to come together and fight this greater evil. And just, I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
You don't know when the catalyst will be in place. Why did Rosa Parks become the catalyst as opposed to the earlier black woman who sat down on the bus just a few months earlier? It's hard to say when the spark in place takes off, the fire begins to expand, intensifies, and next thing you know, you got a whole host of people on fire for justice. And lo and behold, people take off and it becomes contagious. You don't know when it's going to become contagious. It is contagious now. We are still living in the moment of Ferguson, Baltimore, and things will continue and I hope intensify.
I was told that I'm an activist from the way that I've been doing. I never thought I would be doing this type of work. I've never been the talkative type of person, this outspoken, but this made me who I am. And, you know, this is my life mission right now, like, to become an activist, become a civil rights lawyer, you know, to bring justice some way, somehow to America. This helps me. This helps me a lot. Speaking to people and being out here is more of a support than, you know, shutting down or just crying all the time. I believe that the reforms is going to happen, but I believe that it's going to take a long time. It's going to take a lot of powerful people to be on the same page. What do I fear the most? That when my daughter get older, this will still be going on with no change.
Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, given the depth of white supremacy in America, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value. But the indigenous lives will matter, the Asian lives, the white lives, the brown lives, if black lives matter. That's what makes that movement so crucial. And I'm just so very proud and blessed to be an old school brother who's a small part of that movement led by young folk.
The Black Lives Matter movement, sparked by incidents of police violence, is an ideological and political movement fighting for black empowerment and equality. The movement has grown from the hashtag Black Lives Matter to include protests and demonstrations in every major city in America.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
the limelight. Gasoline prices have hit a 7-year high in the United States due to the rising cost of oil, with Americans now paying about $3.40 for a gallon of fuel compared with around $2.10 a year ago. We're prepared for you an article written by Oliver Millman under the heading, Oil Companies' Profits Soared to $174 Billion This Year as U.S. Gas Prices Rose. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a new report, the largest oil and gas companies made a combined $174 billion in profits in the first 9 months of the year as gasoline prices climbed in the United States. The bumper profit totals, provided exclusively to The Guardian, shows that in the third quarter of 2021 alone, 24 top oil and gas companies made more than $74 billion in net income. From January to September of this year, the net income of the group, which includes Exxon, Chevron, Shell, and BP, was $174 billion. Exxon alone posted a net income of $6.75 billion in the third quarter, its highest profit since 2017, and has seen its revenue jump by 60% on the same period last year. The company credited the rising cost of oil for bolstering these profits, as did BP, which made $3.3 billion in the third quarter profit. Bernard Looney, chief executive of BP, told investors at the latest earnings report, rising commodity prices certainly helped. Gasoline prices have hit a 7-year high in the United States due to the rising cost of oil, with Americans now paying about $3.40 for a gallon of fuel compared with around $2.10 a year ago. The Biden administration has warned that price hikes are hurting low-income people, even as it claims it's attempting to implement a climate agenda that would see America move away from fossil fuels, and has released 50 million barrels of oil from the National Strategic Reserve to help dampen costs. But oil and gas companies have shown little willingness so far to ramp up production to help reduce costs, and a new report by the government watchdog group, Accountable US, accuses them of taking advantage of bloated prices, fleecing American families along the way, amid ongoing fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. Kyle Herrig, president of the Accountable US, said, "Americans looking for someone to blame for the pain they experience at the pump need look no further than the wealthy oil and gas company executives who choose to line their own pockets rather than lower gas prices, with the billions of dollars in profit big oil rakes in month after month." Analysis of major oil companies' financials showed that 11 of the group gave payouts to shareholders worth more than $36.5 billion collectively this year, while a dozen bought back $8 billion worth of stock. This apparent focus, rather than on further drilling, has caused some frustration within the federal government, with Jennifer Granholm, the U.S. Energy Secretary, stating that the oil and gas companies are not flipping the switch as quickly as the demand requires. A glut of new oil drilling has made the U.S. awash with oil in recent years, turning the country into a top-level exporter as well as domestic supplier. But this has kept prices low to the displeasure of investors. Halima Croft, head of the Global Commodity Strategy at RBC Capital Markets, of the current reluctance to expand production, said, "A lot of this has been driven by investor sentiment. They don't want them to spoil the party." The situation has left the White House in an awkward position with its commitments to rapidly reduce planet heating emissions, with environmentalists furious at Biden administration attempts to expand drilling and fossil fuel companies also unhappy over some of its earlier climate-related moves, such as shutting down the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. The oil and gas industry has fought Joe Biden's attempts to pause new drilling permits on federal land, despite its willingness to expand operations in order to reap the returns of costlier oil, and the fact the industry currently sits on 14 million acres of already leased land that isn't being used, an area about double the size of Massachusetts. Pavel Molchanov, the analyst at Raymond James, told CNN, "It's not the government that is banning them from drilling more. It's pressure from their shareholders." Aside from its role in the current high gasoline prices, the oil and gas industry is a leading driver of the climate crisis, the reality of which it sought to conceal from the public for decades, and is a key instigator of the air pollution that kills nearly 9 million people a year, a death toll three times that of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020. The American Petroleum Institute, a leading industry lobby group, pointed to a blog that blamed the Biden administration for policies that significantly weakened the incentives to invest in America's energy future, but did not answer questions on production rates of oil companies. The White House recently said it had ordered 50 million barrels of oil released from the Strategic Reserve to bring down energy costs, in coordination with countries including Britain, China, and Japan. In a tweet, President Joe Biden said, "I have been working with countries across the world to address the lack of supply. As a result of our diplomatic efforts, this step will be taken in parallel with other major energy-consuming nations including China, India, Japan, Republic of Korea, and the United Kingdom. The move is an effort to bring down rising gas prices." According to the American Automobile Association, U.S. gasoline prices are averaging about $3.40 a gallon, more than double their price 2 years ago. In a speech, President Biden acknowledged many Americans are struggling with the rising price of gas. President Biden said, "The fact is, we always get through those spikes. We're going to get through this one and hopefully faster. But it doesn't mean we should just stand by idly and wait for prices to drop on their own. Instead, we're taking action." President Biden added, "It will take time, but before long, you should see the price of gas fall where you fill up your tank." The president has scrambled to reshape much of his economic agenda around the issue of inflation, claiming his recently passed $1.2 trillion infrastructure package will reduce price pressures by making it more efficient and cheaper to transport goods. Republicans, meanwhile, have hammered the Biden administration for inflation hitting a 31-year high in October. The Consumer Price Index soared 6.2% from a year ago, the biggest 12-month jump since 1990, and gas prices rose to their highest levels since 2014. The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell tore into the White House in a floor speech recently, saying the victims of higher prices were middle-class Americans. The Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell said the three biggest drivers of the staggering 6.2% inflation rate were logged recently were housing, transportation, and food. He added, Those aren't luxuries, they're essentials, and they take up a much bigger share of families' budgets from the middle class on down. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is an emergency stockpile to preserve access to oil in case of natural disasters, national security issues, and other events. The global release will be the first coordinated effort to increase supply since 2011, when the U.S. and 27 other countries moved to ease supply loss in the conflict that would become Libya's war. Maintained by the U.S. Energy Department, the strategic reserves are stored in caverns in salt domes along the Texas and Louisiana Gulf coasts. There are roughly 605 million barrels of sweet and sour petroleum in the strategic reserve. In a recent statement of U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm said, "As we come out of the unprecedented global economic shutdown because of the coronavirus pandemic, oil supply has not kept up with demand, forcing working families and businesses to pay the price." Claiming, "This action underscores the president's commitment to using the tools available to bring down costs for working families and to continue our economic recovery."
Simple question.
Is Britain being run by a clown? If the rumours are true, that is the view of French President Emmanuel Macron, who was also reported by a satirical French magazine as having said that Johnson had the attitude of a vulgarian. These comments came to light after Macron objected to Johnson's decision to publicly tweet a letter containing a five-point plan to tackle the issue of migrants who use small boats to cross the English Channel, and specifically after the fatal sinking of one boat, costing at least 27 lives.
In a public statement, Macron explained, "I spoke with Prime Minister Johnson in a serious way. I continue to do that, as I do with all countries and all leaders. I am surprised by methods when they are not serious. We do not communicate from one leader to another by tweets and letters that we make public. Macron is alleged to have added privately, 'Bojo talks to me at full speed. Everything is going fine. We have discussions like big people.' And then he gives us a hard time, before or afterwards, in an inelegant way. It's always the same circus." Prime Minister Johnson's actions and Macron's responses have revealed the impact recent developments have had on Anglo-French relations. Macron has claimed Brexit was the starting point of what he called the Johnson circus, and claimed problems such as the petrol crisis that blighted Britain, plus other product shortages, arose from the UK's withdrawal from the EU. He added Johnson portrayed himself as the victim and France as the scapegoat, adding, "In private he says he's sorry to behave like this, but he says that he has to consider public opinion over everything else."
What are we to make of the trading of criticisms between President Macron and Prime Minister Johnson? And why can America no longer seem able to fix poor relations between European countries? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with strong words from the former French ambassador, Sylvie Berman, who said Anglo-French relations haven't been this bad since the Battle of Waterloo. How does the public feel France and Britain are getting on? We put that to them here in central London. This is what they said.
I have no idea, I'm sorry.
Are you French? Ah, we're here in Westminster. Thank you for coming on.
Just 5 questions, then. Thanks for stopping. Probably not the best person to ask.
Oh.
Thanks very much.
Cheers. Yeah. Question one. The former French ambassador says Anglo-French relations haven't been this bad since the Battle of Waterloo. How do you feel France and Britain are getting along?
Well, I think it would be better to answer your question in a way of why don't we be sensible and step back and use statements like approach. As an ordinary citizen, I'm distressed.
Not very well at all. I think they should stay their side of the channel.
I think there have been far worse periods in Anglo-French relations since the Battle of Waterloo. I mean, do you remember what happened in the World War II when we blew up half their navy in the Mediterranean? I think relations were a bit more sour then, but I'd say it could be far worse.
I would say that France and Britain aren't quite as bad as the Battle of Waterloo, but it certainly seems like the situation's deteriorating. It would be good to have a bit more civility on both sides.
I wouldn't really know. I think we're not as strong as we used to be, as like a friendship, say. But I wouldn't know.
Well, it is clearly a deteriorating situation. That's for political reasons. President Macron's facing difficult elections in April. He sees political capital in picking a fight with the UK over Brexit, fish, migrants. And I don't think we're going to get any improvement until after those elections in April.
Since Waterloo? I have no idea.
He's probably not far wrong, actually, or she, if it's a lady ambassador. I think relations aren't good, but I think it's chiefly between the two at the top.
I think we're getting along okay. I think it has been quite tense recently, but I don't think, like, COVID's not really helped that.
Yeah, while it's been a bit tense, it should get sorted in the next year and year and a half.
I'd say he's probably right. Not great. The submarine deal didn't help things.
Well, I think the relationship, there are tensions at the moment, and all I can really say is I hope that everybody really sort of able to come together to try and work through the relations. I think through the dialogue, I think we can get French-British relations back to a really good place.
As far as, you know, the public is concerned, I think we just have to wait and see how this fleshes out and, you know, give it more time before having any sort of substantial judgment towards it.
I don't know, you're asking the wrong person. That's not something I have an opinion on.
I know after Brexit it might be a little hard, but considering the situation, they're more helping. In this COVID as well situation, a bit supportive, I will say, yeah.
I think it's difficult to say at a political level, probably not too well, but I think generally the populations are very agreeable about most things.
President Macron has been reported as describing Boris Johnson as a clown. What does the public think of this sort of commentary and use of language?
Well, I think it's slanderous. Well, if we don't go and elect their presidents over there, they shouldn't be involved in our presidents over here or prime ministers over here.
I'd say Boris has used far worse in the past.
I can't necessarily disagree with the sentiment, but I don't think it was productive in any way.
Well, I wouldn't call him a clown. I'm a big supporter for him.
President Macron seized political capital with the votes he's trying to attract from the nationalist side of the French electorate by attacking Boris Johnson.
I think that is kind of offensive.
I still believe that the rock underneath is that the two nations are more united than they are separated.
It's subjective. It's his own ideal, but he can, yeah, why not? He's a bit of a clown. He's a funny guy.
I don't think it's a good example to set to others, especially the younger generation.
President Macron said that Boris Johnson was a clown. What do you think when people use language like that?
I've seen a lot of videos. They're quite funny, to be honest. But I think he's doing good with vaccine rollout and all of these things. So I think it's quite good. But it's bad, I think, to use clown. But the videos are quite funny.
Probably not clever, because it's, you know, you have to play the game.
I think all I want from language and diplomatic relations is people really sort of talking to each other respectfully.
It's a poor choice if you're saying something about a fellow international leader, even if it's behind closed doors, if that's true.
In my opinion, it's not really called for, even if Boris Johnson is a clown, which, you know, might be many people's opinion.
No, I like Boris Johnson. He's all everybody look after. I like Boris Johnson.
I think, yeah, on a certain level, I guess you have to use your words a little bit wiser. But I mean, I wouldn't massively disagree in that respect, to be honest.
Oh, definitely, it's not good. It's not good. They should not use such language against, you know, such great people. You are representing our country, and saying such language like a clown, it's certainly not look good for them as well.
I tend to agree with what Macron says.
Why can nobody, including America, seem to improve relations between England and France at the moment?
They haven't done for 1,000 years. Why do they expect it to be for the next 500? I don't think they will be improved.
I think the departure from the European Union says a lot. I think the French, they are particularly big players in the EU, and they weren't too happy when we left. I think Macron and Boris, they don't particularly see eye to eye ideologically, and there's a lot of obvious tensions that go with it.
Probably because Macron is worried about the rise of the far right in France and how that's developing a sort of French nationalism that he'll presumably want to try and emphasise his patriotism, get away from it a little bit. And over here, of course, there has been a lot of mood towards patriotism as well, towards this sort of British nationalism and look how great we are and nothing says Britain is superior, quite like having an argument with the French.
Because we haven't got to those elections in April that will allow the watershed to happen. Either Macron will be back in which case he'll probably be far more relaxed with regard to the UK, or he'll be out and we'll be dealing with somebody else.
I think there's too much mistrust. I think if people talk more, then relationships will improve. I mean, that's how relationships always improve, rather than people just saying what they want to say and closing off to anything that's said up by the opposition, or by the opposite side, I should say.
I think because politics is quite selfish at the moment, so everyone's there's been a turn towards like nationalism, which I don't think helps relations with any countries.
Because we have media that's built on tension, so civil discourse at the moment isn't being prioritised. It's more about making a slogan and getting a statement. So I think until we fix that, we're going to be in the same cycle.
I think it's the United States, it's concentrating on itself for now. So, and that's how it's going to be. The Biden administration has made it clear that our people first. So, yeah.
I think basically if people aren't getting along, then it shows that the people involved aren't very good at having open dialogue, aren't able to express themselves and communicate well. So if there's friction between our politicians and other countries, I think it's a lack of communication skills.
France and Britain appear to have much in common. Both countries have similar populations, with France at 67 million and the UK numbering 67 million. Each has a similar gross domestic product, with the UK turning over in 2020 around $2.7 trillion and France $2.6 trillion. But these two countries have a surprisingly long record of fighting each other. Over the last 800 years, France and Britain have fought each other in at least 12 different wars. In total over this time, they have been at war for over 200 years, meaning they have fought each other for about one quarter of all the years since before the Middle Ages.
In the past, the United States would mediate in the affairs of Europe. But this time, if anything, America has made matters worse. Why does Washington seem so powerless in this situation?
Oh, I don't know if they seem so powerless. Maybe they're just fed up of all the silly squabbles that we have over in Europe.
You see the United States withdrawing from all kinds of diplomatic affairs these days. I think they are trying to take a back seat in European affairs in a lot of ways.
Probably because President Joe Biden is focused on his domestic agenda, and after having had some unsuccessful foreign policy elements, I don't think he's eager to throw himself into a complex and hostile situation.
They got the president, we got prime minister. However, they've got loads of states and they all run off states. So if, say, Joe Biden wants to make a decision, it has to go through all the states before that decision can be made. So I think it brings their power down.
Well, you've got the leader of the free world is Joe Biden. He is a weak president in many ways.
It's probably not a bad thing if they are powerless at the moment, because they've come in where they shouldn't have done far too often.
I don't know if Biden is particularly strong. I think he's having to deal with a lot, and I think America's quite a broken country at the moment due to Donald Trump.
They've got their own domestic problems, which, you know, Biden's trying to sort out, and they've reorientated themselves to the east.
I guess everyone's pretty powerless at the moment because they've got, you know, COVID lurking, and there's huge domestic policies, you know, at stake. There's, you know, there's a massive shortage of money, so, you know, you can't, you know, you have to go backwards before you can go forwards, unfortunately.
Well, I think they're dealing with COVID, and there's intense pressure on the United States to get it right.
America, every country's got their own concerns right now, their own things they need to fix. Last thing they need to worry about is fixing somebody else's problems.
I mean, I feel like they need to sort their own stuff out before getting involved. I think, yeah, they've got their own issues, to be honest. And I don't think they're seen as maybe the best mediator at the moment in the world for that kind of thing.
I think it's not that weak right now, but it was when the Trump was there, so there were so many diplomatic, and there were so many, you know, gangs were forming, like, we are supporting of Trump, we are supporting of those, but I think there were more hatred at that time. Now, when Biden came, so I think it's being, things are changing a little bit.
I think they've got their eye very firmly on Northern Ireland, and there's big problems possibly going to happen there, I hope not. But
with all these divisions, where are relations between the UK, France, Europe, and for that matter, America, heading in the long term?
Britain was very good on its own before, it'll be good in the future, America will be, and France will be as well. As long as they don't interfere with our politics and our justice system, then we'll all be getting on okay.
I think the relationship is strong and will stay strong, and these are all very minor inconveniences.
I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic. Obviously, things are on a downwards turn at the moment, but I think that there are enough people who are committed towards a solution, on this, despite the rhetoric, that things will calm, things will get a little bit better.
I'm not saying nothing bad's going to happen, but I think we're more going to stay independent than we used to be with Europe. We'll be more independent.
I think there are short-term problems. Obviously, the EU is still very bitter over the Brexit vote, but we're not coming back.
Well, I think that the presidents are going to change. So soon on after, the relationships are going to change, and I hope that it will be better than now. Yeah.
In the medium term, I'm not that worried. I'm even less worried in the long term. But I believe that as political entities and personalities change, that will return to an even keel. On the other hand, that's with France and Europe in general. It'll be interesting to see what the new Chancellor makes of us in Germany.
Hopefully for the better, I think. I think that each country needs to engage with their own people, but also with each other.
Maybe tension at the moment, but I think in 5 to 10 years' time, we'll all be looking back at this as a minor footnote.
It's a long, long walk, my friend. It's going to be a long walk. So, who knows?
Hopefully to something understandable, agreeable, civil.
I think that we're living in a world where there's a lot of new challenges, and I think these new challenges are also leading to divisions between other countries.
I don't think we're falling apart at all. I think maybe just better leadership in certain situations would improve, I guess, the forecast of that kind of stuff.
It's headed towards a better shaping of the world, okay? And these are five major countries, if you see.
Well, just hope everyone, I think, would hope it's just peaceful and people can just relearn how to reconnect and be a bit more agreeable, I think.
In my opinion, it's probably just going to get worse as global warming, especially global warming gets worse. I think that more, there'll be more call on from the public for governments to be more self-serving rather than actually a more of a kind of global approach, which is probably what we need. Unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen.
Thank you so much. Have a very good afternoon.
Though President Macron said Johnson apologised privately for blaming France publicly about the Channel crossings and the food-related so-called sausage war, he also said of the UK, "It is sad to see a major country with which we could do huge numbers of things being led by a clown." Former French ambassador to the UK, Sylvie Berman, has also stated that relations between France and the UK were the worst they had been since the Battle of Waterloo hundreds of years ago.
Anglo-French relations are at a modern-day low, and no one appears able to de-escalate this ongoing exchange of insults. With America also unable to mediate, France and Britain are left to battle it out in a very public dispute where two premiers treat each other as a scapegoat and a clown. No shots will be fired, but it appears both sides are rerunning their own version of the Battle of Waterloo. Though, in public relations terms, at this stage, the outcome, namely who will win, is very much in doubt. We'll be right back.